everyone, and welcome back to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler, and I'm so happy that you've joined us. Our mission is to provide stories and resources that will give you inspiration to explore all of the possibilities that your life can be. The possibilities are limitless, and guess what? So are you. It begins with believing. Believing in yourself, believing that the future is yours to write, believing that you can not only write your desired future, but that you have everything that you need to write it, edit it as needed, and fully and wonderfully live it. And you don't have to wait. You can start today. The pen truly is in your hand. I cannot wait to share this week's conversation with you. My guest today is one of the 100 top thought leaders in trust around the world, and one of a handful who has the Lifetime Achievement Award as a top thought leader in trust. She is the author of two books on trust, Trust Me, Restore Belief and Confidence in an Uncertain World, and Trusted, Secret Lessons from an Inspired Leader. She delivers programs on trust throughout Asia and North America, and she is known as the Trust Architect. Her name is Lee Bravadani, and it's time to meet her. Unfortunately, just as we were getting ready to wrap up, there was a power outage, but I encourage you to check out Lee's work at her website, leebravadani.com, as well as her two books, Trust Me, Restore Belief and Confidence in an Uncertain World, and Trusted, Secret Lessons from an Inspired Leader. Leah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's nice to meet you finally, Bobby, after kind of having those little conversations back and forth.
Yeah, and thanks to Tom for introducing us. Yeah, it all counts, right? So, hey, I thought we'd get started by you just kind of introducing yourself and what you do, and then we'll, because I love your topic, I love your focus, and then we'll go from there.
Well, thank you. So my name is Lee Bravadani, and I started using the moniker the Trust Architect because I realized I can't build trust for someone, but I can give them the blueprints for how you build trust. So that's where the name came from, because it really is about showing people what you have to do to create this really solid structure of trust within an organization. But then they have to go and build it, because you and I both know, like, you can tell people until you're blue in the face, but if they don't go and actually work and build on that, it doesn't take effect. So for those of you who are just listening, I'm holding up my book, which is Trust Me. This is the latest book. It's called Trust Me, Restore Belief and Confidence in an Uncertain World. So this is the second book that I've written, but I've done a lot of chapters in books, and I don't even know how many now. So that's kind of me.
Yeah. And the cover, that if I saw that correctly, it looked like it was a, like a frayed rope in the middle. Yes. Is that right? Yeah.
Can you see that?
Yeah. I can. I love that. So I'm very curious, because you've spent your whole life in it seems like, right, studying this and practicing it. Why has trust been your focus?
Well, like you, I actually started out in emotional intelligence. So in 2000, when, you know, the book, and Daniel Goleman's book had been out for a few years, and I was just taken with the book and decided that I was writing my practicum in adult education, decided that I would study all of the people that he studied around when he was writing his book on emotional intelligence. That's when I became connected with 6 Seconds. So for those who don't know, Bobby and I have both been certified in emotional intelligence through an organization called 6 Seconds. So I went to their first conference in San Francisco in 2000. So it evolved from there. It evolved from there, from talking about emotional intelligence. I could see that a lot of what it affected was trust. And I became really interested. So, I did a little bit of an off-ramp. And probably the last 15 or maybe a few years less, I've been really studying trust. And my interest in that was piqued when I was in a course with people that you know, Josh Friedman and Tom and a lot of the people from this Emotional Intelligence Network. At that time, it wasn't, you could reach out and get to know the people. So when I went to the conference, I had, you know, these opportunities to sit and talk with people like Peter Salovey, who's now the president of Yale University. And we actually took a drive to there was a big get together afterwards, and it was about an hour to go from the convention to the place where the event was being held. So I had about an hour and a half talking to Peter in the car, which was just such a gift. Yeah. So people like Martin Seligman and Peter Salovey. But so, you know, it was a different time, and I got to meet and talk to all those people. And I realized that it made a difference around how we trust people. And then I dove in. I wanted to learn as much as I could, took different models and came up with my own. So for anyone who is watching this, you'll see that my model is behind me, and I talk about the five tenets of trust. So they're caring, which you can see, caring is like such an emotional intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
So caring, commitment, consistency, competence, and communication. And if you look at those five, you know that if there is a breach in trust, it usually is within one of those areas. But you can really strengthen it. So you build trust by showing people you care.
Yeah.
And that, you know, how does that look? Like if I said to you, hey, Bobby, think of the person that comes to mind when you think of trust.
Mm-hmm.
Who is it and why? Like, why do you trust them?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, a lot of times it's, you know, those stories where someone cared so deeply for you that it's the small things.
Mm-hmm.
That build trust. Usually it's the small things that break it too. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really great point, because I think we usually think about trust being especially broken by the mm-hmm. big things, you know. And when you asked me, the first person that came to mind was my husband, right? Like just, this is such a silly little example, but it's a small example. This was in 2001. We'd moved to Portland, Oregon, you know, miles, you know, all the way across the country from our families. It was around Christmas time, and I was feeling kind of down, kind of blue, and I wanted to hang Christmas lights in my kitchen for whatever reason. And I was frustrated because I just couldn't get the hooks in and all this kind of stuff. And he came out of his office and he's like, "What are you trying to do?" And I'm like, I'm feeling down. I wanted to hang some lights. And he's like, "Let me help." He didn't care about the lights, but he cared about the way I felt. And so bless us, you know, that's what he does. He hung up the lights, and to this day, he still hangs up the lights because I make a mess of it. You know, but it's a tiny thing.
Small things. Yeah.
Yeah.
I talk in one of my blogs, it's called, you know, the top side of the bagel.
I love that.
You know, my husband and I, there's a bakery just down the street, has the best baked goods, and their bagels are amazing. And both of us like the top part with all the sesame seeds. And in the morning, if we have them, we don't have them all the time. He consistently, if he is asking, you know, "Can I make something for you?" he'll toast it and give me the top side of the bagel because he knows that I like them more. Those are the small things that we do that build trust and love.
Yeah.
And it's the small things that if someone's at work, you know, someone comes by and they say good morning to you. This will, you know, for you, because you're a coach as well. I was coaching, and this was when I was just doing emotional intelligence work. And I was asked to coach a young woman who was brilliant, but she was getting overlooked for all of the advancements. Mm-hmm. And she was, you know, she was like, when I talked to her, she was a really kind and very competent young woman, but she was such an introvert that she stuck to herself and she was always working. Like she was there at 7 a.m, head down, didn't do anything. And so I said, "Okay, when you come in the morning, I want you to start saying good morning to people." And she said, "Well, that's silly. They don't like me." And I said, just do it. Just say good morning. And then when you go for your coffee break, start going to a coffee break and ask someone if they'd like to join you. And she said, "But if they say no, then say, can I bring you back a coffee?"
Yeah.
And she said, "That's ridiculous." So a month later, she got back to me. And, you know, I was coaching her. A month later, she got back to me. And she said, my manager called me into the office and asked, people have been going up to him and saying, what has happened? She's a kind person. Anyway, she ended up getting the promotion because she just assumed that people didn't like her. And these small gestures all of a sudden brought her into the group. And she told me, and this is the one thing I love. She said, the only reason I did it was so that I could meet with you in our next coaching call and tell you you were full of crap.
Okay, right. As long as someone tries it.
Yeah, I love that. It's the small things that make a difference. Yeah.
Have you ever read the book, Extraordinary Leadership, Turning Good Managers into Great Leaders by Zinger and Folkman?
No.
It's a fabulous book. I think they're based out of Seattle, but I don't remember. And they studied, I don't even know how many organizations, but it's very in depth. And they talked about all the different ways a person can lead. And they said, while there's no really one right way to lead, they did come up with the 10 deadly sins of leadership. Like if you exhibit these, you're going to kill your leadership. The very number one, the deadliest sin, the absence of basic human courtesy, saying good morning. If someone's kid was sick, right? And they come back to work, hey, how's your son? Remembering people's names. It's like, how can that be? How can we miss that? It seems so obvious. But to your point, it's those small things like that. That's a great story. Yeah. Just saying hello.
You know, and there are big trust breaches. So if you have an organization that has, you know, makes a huge faux pas in there, whatever they're making doesn't work or they're not answering calls or anything, and they try and hide it. That's the other thing. Like if you mess up, people accept that. If you mess up, and heck, I'm as bad as anyone. I hate being told when I've done something stupid. And it happens often enough that I'm getting comfortable with it. Yeah,
unfortunately. It's like, oh, well, you know, we know when we make a mistake.
Yeah. But you know, if you make the same mistake over and over and over again, then there's something drastically wrong. So if you're managing a team and they keep making the same mistake, then perhaps you've got the wrong person in the position. Mm-hmm. And it's not an area of competence. But honestly, out of all of the five tenets, I find that the competence issue seems to be the least important, because if someone really cares and is working is so committed to the job and they don't have all the skills, then most companies will recognize that the other four, that their communication is really good, they're committed to it, they care about the company and the organization and the rest of the people, they will spend the money to train them. But if you've got someone who is brilliant, and like we know those people, right? The brilliant people who are just, they don't care about anybody else. They constantly tell you how bright they are and why you should listen to them. Yeah. They don't seem committed because they're always looking for the next opportunity. We know that those are people that we don't usually trust. So competence, even if it's really high and the other ones are low, we have a word for that. They're usually called a-holes.
Yeah. And we don't like working with them.
No.
You're totally right. That's really interesting, though, because I think so many people think that competence is the driver. Yeah. But when you really think about it, I mean, and you've studied it, but when you really think about it, as you're explaining it, it makes perfect sense, because competence can be taught.
You want the skill. If I'm going in and I have a heart surgeon and I've been told that he's absolutely brilliant, well, then maybe the weight of their competence is more important than them coming in and saying, good morning, Lee. It's really good to see you.
Right.
But I always think when I had that image, did you ever see the little show with Harvey Korman and Tim, and he was the dentist?
Oh, my God. That's one of the funniest skits on Carol Burnett ever.
So for anybody who is listening, now you have to wait. Don't do it right now. Finish listening to us. But when you're done, you have to go see that clip. It is like the most hilarious scenes, but he's totally incompetent, but he's so cheerful.
He really is. When he shoots, he accidentally, like, what does he do? He gives the shot of Novocaine into his own hand by accident. That is just, oh my my God, it's precious.
And then his hand flopping around and then his leg. And yeah, it's just absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely. When it's someone who has to have the competence to operate or do something on us, we trust that they have the skill. So the proper context.
Okay. So care, I love that. So caring, any other tips you'd have for someone if they're trying to build their capacity, whatever you'd say, in the caring component?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you mentioned a lot of them. Being aware of people. Now, I'm speaking at a few conferences and I'm talking about being able to build trust in a virtual, and oh, yeah. It's going to be a hybrid world. And so all of the information is pointing to, we're not going to go back to a bricks and mortar full time. I think that we will go back, but I haven't met anyone who says, I want to go back 5 days a week in a bricks and mortar building.
Nope.
So you have families that they were paying 50% of their salary on childcare. And so now they're working from home. They've actually increased their take-home pay by that much because they're not having to pay for childcare expenses. So there's some really compelling reasons to allow them to continue at least part-time. But the other side of the coin is that for a lot of employees, if you want to get promoted, a lot of those happen in the hallways. So you might be two steps removed from the president of the company, but they see you on a regular basis in the hallway and you have an opportunity to have those conversations that you wouldn't normally have. They can see the work that you're doing because you're actually there. So for people, I think it's this, if you want to be trusted and promoted, then there has to be this opportunity to both combine all the work that you do from home with the appearance and the work that you do in a bricks and mortar place.
Yeah.
But that wasn't really the question you asked. You said, what are some of
it? It's a great point. It's a great point, though.
Yeah. And, you know, like I had a phone call the other day where a colleague called up and said, you know, I signed up for a friend's workshop because I was trying to help her out. And, you know, it was a colleague. And she said, I really didn't feel like I got what I wanted to get out of this.
Yeah.
And I just asked one question. What did she say when you called and asked her? And you know what the answer is? Oh, I haven't called her yet.
Yeah.
You know her. So I just wanted to talk to you first. I said, but what can I do? Like,
yeah.
So
why not call her?
One of the things that if you want to show caring is don't say anything about a person behind their back. I mean, you guys know this. Everybody knows this. Don't say something behind someone's back that you wouldn't say to their face. So the
Absolutely.
First person that you should talk to if you have a complaint, and it's from my perspective, there's ways of doing it. Become curious. So if you want to show caring, instead of being judgmental, and I'm still learning this. So I have that judgmental brain where, you know,
we all do.
Smack talking.
At least inside your head.
At least inside my head. But then I try and put that aside and become curious.
Yeah.
And say, now, why is this? And when I become curious, I'm not quite as judgmental. And when I become curious, I give the benefit of the doubt and I ask the questions.
Yeah.
And it can sound like, you know, what's going on? I saw something and I'm just curious. It's, you know, I don't know the whole story. Can you tell me what's going on in the background? You know, so when you use those questions and it's not judgmental, it's not like, what's going on? And so tone is very important. Then you're the person that they can trust to speak well of them, even when they're not in the room, because they know if there's a problem, you'll go directly to them.
It's a great connection, you know, because I think that when you hear people talking about other people and those people aren't around, I don't know how you are, but one of the first things I think of is, what do they say about me when I'm not around?
Yeah, it's different. Like, I feel like husbands are, that's a complaint-free area that you can just go
that's
to town
right.
and complain as much as you like.
That's right. Because you know, it's a trusted role there, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, I'm kind of joking, but not really.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I also love the connection to the curiosity, because I've always talked about that, like when I'm teaching managers how to coach, you have to navigate with curiosity, because when you do that, you're suspending judgment and people can feel when they're being judged. And when you're being judged, you shut down. But I never made that connection back to when you're doing that with someone and you're being curious and you're exploring, then they know that they can trust you to go to them when there's an issue. I'd far rather have, my husband always says, like, I'm one of those people that I would rather talk about something than let it fester. And sometimes people don't like that, but it's because it's uncomfortable. But to me, it's like, hey, this is just something that can be solved. Because if we both have good intentions, we can solve this. It can be solved. You
and
know?
Even practicing a conversation of curiosity with best intentions.
That's right.
So, you know, say, this is unlike you because I know that you have such good intentions, but I'm curious because I don't understand this. Yeah. Then you're setting them up as someone that you believe the best in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another. And then, you know, like we can go through the commitment.
Yeah.
Yeah. How to volunteer. Have you ever led a volunteer group?
Yes. I have.
So you know what I so if you want to see commitment, start out with a volunteer group and who is still committed, fifth meeting in.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of volunteer work. And one of the things that I found is that there's a core group that are committed.
Yeah.
And then there's some people, and I should be more curious. This is me being judgmental. There's some people who like to put on their resume that they did this volunteer work at this ABC event.
Yeah.
So commitment looks like doing what you say you do long after the time you first agreed to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what commitment looks like.
And I could see where, you know, when you said the volunteer organization, that's a great example, right? But I can see how people would kind of come up short in the commitment area. You know, inadvertently or, you know, best of intentions doesn't matter. But I can see how people come up short there. And so is that really just doing what, you know, kind of what you just said, you know, doing what you say you're going to do long after you made the commitment?
Yeah. When you make a commitment, that shows part of your character. So, you know, like you hear a lot of some of the different models talk about character and competence together as part of the trust model. And I definitely think that that's part of commitment, is it shows your character when you put those together, character and integrity, and then consistency. In HR, one of the things that I recognized years ago is that if someone was very inconsistent in their work, that it was brilliant one day and it was not the next day and they weren't showing up, then quite often it was an indication of an addictions issue. Now, it's not a blanket thing, but in HR, I would, again, become curious. And if someone was having trouble being consistent, instead of being judgmental, see if there's something that's happening. And it's not always addiction. It could be there's things happening at home that are really, really tough.
Yeah.
You know, you find out, and this is where you combine the caring with, you know, if someone's not consistent. But I'd rather have someone that had middle of the road work that was consistent on a regular basis, so I knew what to expect, than someone who was brilliant one day and then the next day they didn't get things done. Because I've been caught as a manager believing someone, you know, here's your assignment, get it done, and then I wouldn't stay on top of it.
Right.
And it wouldn't get done. And then you wear it as a manager.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to trust people to be consistent.
Yeah.
And you have to know what level. So if you are interested, there's some excerpts in the book where it actually shows the 10 stages of competence within a person. And so what you can expect as far as, you know, there's some people that you can just tell them what to do and then let them run with it. That there's other people that you have to be very specific. I want you to do this by this day and get back to me. Check and make sure before you put it through that it is exactly what I want. And once I've signed off on it, go ahead. I mean, it goes from 1 to 10 in that range.
I love that. I have a question there. Let's say that you're dealing with the person because I deal with a lot of top performers, and many of them fall into that bucket of tell me what you want. If I have questions, let me ask my questions and then let me do it. Like, micromanaging doesn't work very well. What happens if you try to micromanage someone and they're operating out of that, if I say I'm going to do it, it'll be done, it's going to be done well. What happens then? I'm sure you must have encountered that.
Well, if they get it done, it's great.
Yeah.
And if they get it done to the qualifications and the quality and the expectations that is required, that's great.
Right.
But if they believe, and this has happened, I've managed people that believe they're more competent than they are.
True.
That's when you have to get into, you know, there's really specific things and you have to have the conversation. Like you said, you have to have sometimes those difficult conversations where you say, okay, here's the level that we need to have it at.
Here's the definition.
And here's the definition. And you need to be able to express it in such a way that there is absolutely no doubt that they have the competence and the qualifications.
Yeah.
So you can't just say, go ahead and do it. Say, okay, so I hear that you want to do it and you've got some really great ideas. So let's just brainstorm for a minute and you tell me what you plan, because I might have information that you need to get the project done. So you put it back upon yourself. You know, let me make sure I've given you all of the information that you need in order to get the best possible.
Love that. Because then it changes the feel of it.
Yeah.
You know, okay. So we've got the caring, the commitment, the consistency. And you mentioned earlier, competence is the, you said, I mean, it's important, but it's the one that can be, maybe doesn't, how'd you put it earlier? Doesn't affect trust as much?
That's been my experience, because you can train for competence.
Yeah. Okay.
You can often train for competence, and it depends on the complexity of the position that they have. So that the more complex the position, the more competence you want them to have in order to trust that individual. So the trust that I might have for someone who is, I've hired as a gardener to pull weeds, I might trust them with the keys to my yard, but not the keys to my car.
Right.
You know.
What are you trusting them with?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. That makes sense. And then what about communication?
Communication ties it all together. I think it's kind of the bedrock. It's the foundation. So you have to be able to communicate. One of the things, you know, and we've all heard how Maharabian, his visual, verbal, and vocal, and it's been so misunderstood and people have misused that whole thing. So for those of you who might not have heard, he was he talked about the most important part of communication, 57% was visual, 38% was vocalization, and only 7% were the words that we used. But he was talking about face-to-face communication when you're discussing something with someone, very different from people saying how you look is 57% of how you communicate. That's not it. But if I am telling you that I am just fine with everything you say, but my arms are crossed and I'm turned away and I'm scowling and my chin is jutted out, that communicates something completely different. So that's where the 57% come in. And then it increases if it's just vocalization. So if I'm talking to you on the phone and I say, no, I'm not angry, why are you asking?
I think something different might be going on.
So the words I said was, no, I'm not angry, why are you asking?
Mm-hmm.
But how I said it gave
everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So communication is really important. And virtually, that's been compromised, because you and I are talking, we're seeing each other kind of from the shoulders up. But when I am working in an office with someone, I'm seeing them going into a meeting, and if someone's nervous, their leg is bouncing or their hand might be, and then you can go up and you can have a conversation with them.
Yeah.
So much of communication, now we have to rely on asking the question, how are you feeling? You know, I can see that, you know, you weren't making eye contact, or you look a little distressed. Can you tell me what's going on?
Yeah.
What's happening right now? So communication is really important in trust because you have to be able to see all of the communication.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to see it more than just the words that someone is saying.
Yeah. Well beyond just the words.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
When you're talking about the body language, I remember reading this once. Someone had studied it and they said that the people who bounce their feet, like when they're sitting and they're constantly bobbing their foot up and down, that it's a sign of nervousness. And I started really observing it and I'm like, ooh, that's really interesting. But I mean, you don't even think about looking for those things necessarily. And certainly you can't do it on a Zoom call, you know? Yeah. So when you work with organizations and you give them this a blueprint, because you said you can't build the trust for them, do you just kind of go through these five tenets and help them understand how they can become more, I don't know, adept at these things?
So for a minute, I want you to think about the person in the office that people have difficulty with. And so no one trusts them. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of conflict because, management doesn't know how to handle them. So a lot of times it's going in and first of all, uncovering and being able to find out what's happening within the organization. What are the areas? So I do a really quick survey that, and I've done a lot of different certifications, but the one I use is like really simple because it gives me everything I need. It takes a minute on the web for people to go in and it's all anonymous. And I find out the areas that people feel are really strong and areas that they feel that there's still some needs. And then it's a matter of being able to train people so that they know what to look for, and not just in others, but in themselves, because a trust always starts from yourself and works outwards. So if you understand what you can do to build trust, it's like that young girl who I mentioned, I told her to start saying good morning because I watched her interact with people. I had that benefit of seeing how she was with other people. So from my perspective, it was like, wow, this is pretty basic. It's,
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Being able to actually discover what's happening within the organization. And I can, there's training that can be done.
Yeah.
And then getting the managers on board. Some of the best companies I've worked with that have really high trust amongst the people, the management also got behind it as well and said, here's our expectations. We're not just doing this training because we need another training program. I'm going to be monitoring and doing it as well.
That makes a huge difference.
So, this is part of the blueprints. Here's what I see. Here's what I discover. Here's what we can build together. And then once they're given that, it's checking them on a few occasions and making sure that they're actually following it and they're going through it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I love the blueprint idea. I love the, trust can be built, And you've also said, I know in one of your articles I was reading, that trust can be repaired once there is a breach. And that made me curious, like what are the main things that you see where that causes a breach in trust?
I'm going to quote some of my colleagues. So these are other people that are part of the 100.
Yeah.
So the thought leaders. So Stephen Covey is one of the top thought leaders in trust as well. And I like it was actually his father. So there were two Stephen Coveys. Now it's Stephen Covey Jr. who's doing all the work within trust. But his father talked about the emotional bank account. So that you would invest trust. And so from my perspective, if you're constantly investing in people and building trust, then you're investing in this on a regular basis. So if you have a small withdrawal, there's still a reserve there. Those people who are constantly drawing out of the bank without putting anything in, eventually the bank is depleted and they're going to have a heck of a time.
Yeah.
But hopefully I explained it well enough. The people who have built up trust over years and years and years, if they screw up occasionally, which we all do, then it's easier to repair.
Yeah.
So you have to invest in it, which means be transparent, tell the truth. And truth can be very dependent on how people view a different situation. But be someone who like I said, speaks well of people. Mm-hmm. Or if they have a complaint, they speak to the person individually. Like, there's so many things that we can do on a daily basis to build trust.
Here are my three insights for thriving. Number one, I loved Lee's five tenets to trust: caring, commitment, consistency, competency, and communication. I think that's a great framework for us to use, not just in organizations, but in our personal lives as well. Number two, you may have noticed that we spent a lot of time on caring, as it seems sort of like the heartbeat of the process. If you think about a leader or a loved one or a friend that you trust, caring is probably a pretty big factor in why you trust them. I think that we can feel someone cares about us. And conversely, we can probably feel when they don't care about us. I know that for me, when I know that someone truly cares about me and what's important to me, it's pretty easy to trust them. And finally, number three, I found it interesting that Lee said that trust is built or lost in the small moments and the small things. It made perfect sense to me as we talked about it. I thought about her two examples of ways to build trust in those small moments. You know, number one, be curious. And I know that I've mentioned in other podcast episodes, but when we are curious, we are naturally suspending judgment. Think about what that does for trust. Or another way to think about that is, think about how trust isn't created when we feel like we are being judged. And curiosity is the antidote for that. And the second thing, and this is probably something that we've heard since kindergarten, don't always execute on it maybe, but don't say things about someone behind their back. Don't talk about them when they're not around. And then as I reflected on this interview, I was thinking about this, you know, the small moments. And I was thinking about those that I feel really care about me. And I thought, okay, why do I feel like they care about me? And I think that those two that Lee mentioned are perfect. I also thought of another one, and maybe it's just me, but this is a really big one for me. But I feel cared about when someone truly listens to me without an agenda, without their own assumptions, and with patience, where they give me the time to express myself. And maybe they go even a step further and they ask more questions. They ask clarifying questions. And I get that sense that, wow, this person is truly trying to understand me. And I don't know about you, but number one, I feel really cared for in those moments. And number two, I really trust the person who gives me that gift. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode. If you are finding value in this podcast, we hope that you will consider helping us spread the word by sharing it with a friend or a colleague, as well as leaving us a review. Those help us reach more people and hopefully help them to thrive. Because our mission here at Unyielded is to provide hope, knowledge, and assurance that we can all thrive and flourish no matter what.